Can I talk about collapse models? This is the last of the three interpretations I want to cover. There's lots more stuff out there that you could read, but so this goes back originally to Philip Pope. But then the model that people mostly talk about, at least from a sort of pedagogical point of view, is by Gerardi, Rimini, and Weber. And then a particular version of that model I'm going to show you is due to John Bell. So this model, this version, he first presented it actually in 1987 at a conference I happened to be at as an undergraduate at Imperial College. It's the first time I saw him give a talk. And what he did is he took this model, this class model of GLW, and sort of made it much more accessible and understandable. It appears as the final chapter in the book. There's a book which is a collection of his papers called Speakables and Unspeakables. There's another book which is a collection of his papers as well, broadly overlaps. You get the title of that one. It also has this paper. And there's copies of both those books in the library. Those books make very good reading. There's a lot of different things there, like his original paper on Bell's, lots of them. Okay, so class models. So motivation is to solve the measurement problem by explicitly modifying the Schrodinger equation so that we get collapse. The idea is, if you have a small object, like an electron, or an atom, or maybe a molecule, then it should be hardly influenced at all by this modification. If you have a large object, like a pointer in a measurement apparatus or a cat, or there's many examples, then it should be strongly influenced by modification. Show you an explicit model, the one due to Bell, which is based on the one due to GLW. But let me give you some possible physical justification for this. Because a lot of these models here are all very ad hoc. They're just invented to do exactly its job without saying why. But there's justification, so physical justification coming from quantum gravity. And this is still speculative, of course. you find these kinds of arguments due to different works, one by Leo Sciossi and the other by Roger Penrose. So. And the version I'm going to, so Diossi was earlier, but the version I'm going to present is due to Penrose. So, imagine you have some massive object, so suddenly a ball would do it, even a grain of sand, you pick up something quite small, something which is, so Penrose talks about being about the planet mass, which I forget what the planet mass is, but it's something which can just be visible, so that we and then we take this massive object and we interact it with a smaller quantum system and put it into a quantum superposition. So it's either here or here. So now this mass is in a superposition being either here or here. Now, according to general relativity, the mass will induce some curvature of the metric field around it. And if it's here, you'll get one sort of metric field induced, just my attempt to draw a metric field. And if it's over here, you'll get different colors, hardly visible here. There'll be a different different metric field extending out into all space. So you'll have one geometry over here and another geometry over here. Penrose argues that you have a problem, which is that there's no intrinsic way of, there's no covariant way of identifying points in one geometry given. So imagine you have a certain space-time point over here. You want to say it's the same as the one in this solution. So here you have a geometry of a metric and a certain point. You want to say there's a certain point here which is in this one and also in this one. And you can't do that in a covariant way. The problem is that any solution in general relativity is only physical up to diffeomorphisms. Have you done diffeomorphisms in your geometry? Okay. So if you have a solution to the equations of general relativity, the physically meaningful properties are things that are invariant under different diffeomorphisms. And so a point X in itself isn't a physically invariant property. You can't say that there is a certain point X. You can only really say that there are places where the fields have certain values relative to one another. Penrose says, well, then that's a problem, because how do you identify a point in this one geometry that you have with a point in the other geometry? Okay, so there's no way, if you want this in a very fashion, identifying points in this geometry with this one. Remember, these two extend over all space. So if you can't do that, then you have a problem with of identifying the notion of time is consistent in these two geometries. So it becomes impossible, as Penrose argues, to have a sort of consistent notion of time here, say a foliation into time, into space like hypersurfaces, that maps in some clear way to the same thing in this solution. Okay. And you want that if you want to keep evolving this state forward. So you have a superposition of mass, the two places entangled with the gravitational field, and you want to be able to afford in time. And you have this problem that you can't identify points, so you can't really find a way of evolving it forward in time. So this is Penrose's argument. So Penrose says, well, something's got to give. Okay. This situation is untenable, and so he says, well, therefore, we must have collapse. This argument is in some sense, it's an argument of the form, this is crazy, therefore it can't be, which is not as good as an argument which is of the form that this has to be like this for such and such reasons. So this is an argument from inconsistency, according to Penrose. Now, actually, more recently, people, myself, and Shasta, Bruckner, Kuminia, Giacomini, have been Shasta is in Vienna, and Kuminia is now in Zurich, but she was supposed to be here. I've been thinking about ways to talk about identifying these points and actually take advantage of the fact that we can't identify points in a consistent fashion. That's a different story, which I won't have time. So this is Penrose's argument. So then, if something's got to give, well, we know that if this particle is very small, you can have a superposition. You know, an electron can be in a superposition of going through its barometer in two places at once, so to speak. So there's a certain scale which you need to find. And so Penrose has an idea as to what the scale should be. And his argument is that the scale on which the time on which this collapse happens is equal to h bar over delta E. So E delta. Is his notation. And E delta is the gravitational self energy. What he calls the gravitational self energy. And it's given by this attempt to justify this expression. Rho is the density of the mass density of the distribution of this particle. And that this is the density distribution in position one. So the upper position, for example, rho prime is the density of position 2. And you're looking at the difference between those densities.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
This argument is a problem when we believe that, like, this gravitational source can be in superposition, but it eventually collapses when we want to, like, measure some particle in the presence of these fields. But if we don't believe in collapse, like, if we think that it's in superposition and all of the superposed positions are going to affect the particle in the gravitational field, then it wouldn't be a problem for covariance, right?
So Penrose is trying to argue that it is a problem because you can't identify points across, there's no unique way of saying this point in one sum of this superposition is identified with this point in another.
I mean, if you believe that all of this the gravitational source actually exists in all of these superposed positions,
yeah,
then it wouldn't be, like, we can still identify the points and it would just act as a, like, we don't need to say that, like, the particle is affected by all of it, all of the wave function as a whole.
You could imagine in principle some sort of interference experiment, the more entangled. And one of the problems, actually, this is true in general for these collapse models, is that experimentally collapse looks very similar to decoherence, where you don't have collapse, you have entanglement, but you don't have access to those degrees of freedom that you entangle with. So in principle, you can imagine trying to reverse the situation, so you go back to the two different geometries so you get to try to reverse the situation. In practice, that would be quite hard. But there is a difference. Yeah, I think at this point, this is just a very rough argument that Penrose gives. And it's kind of the one strong motivation, but it's motivation for these kinds of class models. I think it's not simple. So
now let me give you the model.
Could you explain the meaning of the T again?
So this is basically the time scale on which this collapse happens.
Oh, okay.
So you want this time scale to be very large. We have a small system, and very big, we have a big system. Sorry, very small, very large, yeah, very big, you have a small system, very large, very small, you have a big system. So, first of all, we have, if you specify an interpretation, you have to first of all give the ontology. And the ontology is, first of all, you have a wave function. Same notation that Bell uses in his paper. So he chose to represent the positions by R's. And you have a way to get John Bell called local ripples. So Bell invented this word, bubbles, which are things that are able to be. So these are just the real things in your theory. So the ontological stuff. But then you also talk about local bubbles. So you may have the wave function, which is a bubble, like it's a real thing in this some parts of the ontology, but it's not local. So then you talk about producing local bubbles. And in the GRW, GRW model, there's two ideas for what the local bubbles might be. So John Bell had what he called the flash ontology. Actually, he didn't call it that, but other people called us. And the flashes, I'll explain this later, the flashes are the jumps. So you end up having these jumps that hit a certain point in space-time. And he takes those to be the things that make up your local bubbles. But the reason you want local bubbles is because you want to account for the appearance of the world, so you want to account for tables and chairs and all this stuff. And so in this ontology, tables and chairs are made out of these flashes. And then Girardi who is the G in GRW, had a mass density in them. And then two, so this is the ontology, and then you need the dynamics. And here we have basically the dynamics are Schrödinger evolution. Except and jump the person. So I'll be very explicit about what I mean by this jump mathematically. But basically, a jump will occur, will hit a certain particle in here, and there's a way that the wave function is altered afterwards. And it will you'll do exactly what you want to do in terms of hardly affecting small objects, but strongly affecting the big objects.
So jump is actually instantaneous collapse.
Say again, sir?
Jump is actually instantaneous collapse.
It's completely instantaneous, yeah. Yeah, it's a point of time. I'll show you the model.
Turn
on
the mic.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Used to be a microphone. There used to be a speaker in the ceiling they could talk to you. Okay. So here's how the jump process works. So first of all, there's a certain probability per unit time per particle for a jump. And that is 1 over tau. And tau is, in this model, is a new fundamental constant of nature. Okay. And one can be a bit more explicit about this. What you really want to have is a Poisson process. The probability that you have E jump events, so you have the probability that you have M in time, have M jumps in time, is given by this. It's a Poisson distribution. And when a jump happens, the wave function gets modified. So I still need to explain various bits of this. X is going to be a random position that's chosen in a certain weighted fashion. J is a function that does this, and I'll give you an example of that. And R is a normalization factor, but it's also going to be used in choosing the probability for different positions where the jump occurs. So the usual choice for J is this. And here we have A, and A is another fundamental constant of nature. Those are the two fundamental constants you need to set up this model. Okay. Just a few more things to say to set up the model. You define R in this way, so you're hitting the wave function.
It's jump.
Jump. The clap center X is chosen with probability distribution R X squared. And there's an N here as well. So I should say also the N is chosen randomly. Well, I think I should say this here. So chosen randomly with a flat distribution. So you just choose one N randomly. So you choose one particle randomly with this probability. You hit it with a jump. And the clap center to where this jump hit is chosen with this distribution. I think I've said everything about the model. Any questions?
What are the fundamental constants related to, like?
Yeah. Okay. That'll be the next point I'll make.
And also, the whole framework is not covariant, right?
Yep. That's a problem with these models. People who work on class models have spent a lot of time trying to make these things covariant. There is, in John Bell's paper, there is a, so first of all, he's working here with non-relativistic quantum theory. There is a, if you just look at the flashes, the jump centers, okay, well, because you're in non-relativistic quantum theory, you don't have Lorentz invariants. It's the wrong symmetry for that model. But you can look at what would happen if you do a two-time translation, so you move this system over here ahead in time or this one ahead in time. So you can transfer, so if you have two systems that are spatially separated, you can move, so one is ahead of time, the other is ahead in time. And that's kind of the residue of Lorentz transformations in this non-relativistic limit. You can alter the time at which two non-interacting systems. And John Bell shows that this model, the flashes are invariant under this two-time translation. So there's a kind of Lorentz invariance, sort of version of it. But if you want to make it fully Lorentz invariant, that's hard.
Sorry. So I was going to ask, so if N is chosen randomly, how does this get rid of any of the problems we had with measurement?
Yeah, so I'll think the next thing after I've answered. Yeah, so you two are asking good questions because you're anticipating the next stuff I'm going to say. Yeah.
Does it mean that if you want to like believe in quantum and covariance at the same time, the covariance of physical laws, we always fall into some many word approaches because we cannot believe in collapse?
Yeah, it's a good question. and I've written papers on this. I think it's hard to avoid that, but people did try very hard, especially work that was done in the 1990s, to try and make these models Lorentz covariant. So people tried to make the de Broglie-Bohm model Lorentz covariant. People have tried to make class models Lorentz covariant. I don't think any of those attempts are very natural, but perhaps they're different. Whereas the many worlds approach, I think I didn't emphasize this when I talked about the many worlds, but the many worlds approach, the proponents claim it is actually local. It doesn't violate Bell's inequalities, but the when you derive Bell's inequalities, you're assuming that you have definite outcomes in the two ends of the experiment. And in the many worlds approach, you don't have definite outcomes. So you can regard it as a local interpretation. So the many worlds approach, if you want to believe in covariance and you don't mind having an infinite number of different worlds, then that's a way forward. Okay, so let me come to these points that you've raised. So first of all, and they're kind of connected. So first of all, Girardi, Rimini, Weber made suggestions as to what these physical constants should be equal to. They suggested that tau should be 10 to the 8 years, 10 to the 15 seconds. So that's quite big. This means that if you've got an individual particle going through an interferometer, you know, you're not going to see it collapse. You wait a very long time. However, if you have a large number of particles, then the probability of seeing a collapse becomes much bigger, because if you have, you know, it becomes n over, you know, if you have a lot of particles, then the probability goes n over tau. So if you have Avogadro's number of particles, then you'll see a collapse very quickly, at a very short time.
How the particle is defined in this model?
Sorry again?
How the particle is defined as elementary
particles? So they're just taken to be elementary particles, yeah. And there's not a very sophisticated discussion of that, I think. Whatever, electrons, protons, there's not a very sophisticated discussion. So A in the model is taken to be 10 to the minus 5 centimeters. So 10 to the minus 5 centimeters is much bigger than an atom, but it's smaller than the eye can discern. Okay. So let me now show how this works, how this solves the measurement problem.
What is the motivation for these numbers? Like, because it's been 200 years.
Say again, sorry?
What is the motivation for these numbers?
There's
an experiment for.
Yeah, so they wanted to put some numbers down in the paper, so they just chose these numbers. The motivation.
The biggest thing you could think of.
Yeah, well, they wanted the collapse to happen very quickly for large objects, but to essentially never be seen for small objects. They probably could make this a lot smaller, But I think if I get time, there are some experiments that constrain this, and I don't know the latest state of play, but if you make tau too small, then you'll get a heating effect that you would expect to observe. So you want it really to hardly affect individual quantum systems. Okay, so let's just consider a typical quantum experiment. I want a typical quantum experiment not to be affected. So imagine you have a particle and it's in a superposition of being in two places. Okay, so let's imagine this distance is less than a, and this distance is greater than a. Every 100 million years, this particle will get hit. So there's a very small chance that it will get hit by a jump process. If it does get hit by a jump process, well, the jump processes are chosen. Where is it? There. The collapse center is chosen with this distribution here. So it'll either be the probability of the collapse center being chosen here, where there's no amplitude, is essentially zero, or is zero, if there's no amplitude. So the collapse center will either be chosen over here or over here. And then you're going to hit this by multiplying it with the Gaussian, with the J function. And this will be roughly in this wave packet, so it'll be some, if the collapse center is here, for example, it'll be something like this. So you'll multiply that by that, which will modify slightly this, the shape of this wave packet, but not much. And it will completely eliminate the other one. Okay. So every 100 million years, you'll have an event where you don't see interference. So that's not very interesting. That just shows you that for typical quantum experiments, you just see what you normally expect to see. So now let's look at superposition. Sorry, I want to look at a measurement situation. So imagine you have a pointer on a scale, initially in the zero state. Particle comes in and comes out again. And the pointer either goes to a negative position or it goes to a positive position. So the notation for that is this. So A1 is where the pointer is over here. A2 is where the point is over here. And let's write that down as a wave function instead of as a state vector. So what we have then is alpha some function here for a particle 1, and then out of space here. I'm going to start again over here. Alpha. So we'll imagine that particle 1 is the particle in the system we're looking at, and particles 2 all the way through to n are in the pointer. So okay, so we have particle 1. We have the first term where particle 1 is in some state coming out. And then the pointer, I'm going to model the pointer in a very simple way. So I'm modeling the pointer as if it were just a product of wave functions for each of the particles in the pointer. This is not a very good model, but it's sufficient for my purposes. So every particle in the pointer is just in the same function, has the same wave function associated with it, and we just take the product of all those wave functions to give. And then we have the other term, which is modeled in the same kind of way. So is that clear what I'm doing there? And we're going to imagine that this A1 and A2 do not overlap. Okay. Okay. So let me now talk through what happens. So now we choose, first of all, we choose a particle at random to get hit. Okay. And we don't have to wait very long for this, because the time scale now, the probability of this time scale is now very short, because we have large number of particles in the pointer. There's going to be roughly Avogadro's number of particles. So this pointer will very quickly get a jump happening in this system. So we choose a particle at random. There's a very small probability that it's the system particle. Most likely, it's going to be one of the n minus one particles in the pointer. Okay. And the particle will be hit. Now we have two. We can maybe just draw these two wave packets. They're two separate. So A1, A2, and of course the actual wave function is a product of many of these. So we'll either get hit over here or over here. If we get a hit on the one side, on the one side here, okay, then the Gaussian will effectively kill off all the terms that are in the A2 side. Is that clear? It's just really now the n particle version of what we had already, or the n minus one particle version of what we had already. So the Gaussian will kill the terms on the other side, and we'll just be left with the term for one of the two pointer outcomes. So we'll go to A It'll be slightly modified, but really hardly at all. So almost exactly the same as it was, but we lose the other term. And so that's how measurement works. And also, this isn't completely obvious, but the probability that you end up collapsing on this term is going to go as alpha squared, because we're choosing the collapse centers with that probability distribution. Okay, so it has an alpha squared probability of being collapse center being in this term, and a beta squared of it being in this term, more or less. So this gives you a pointer that now collapses in two terms. Yeah, I just have a few minutes left. And I don't want to spend any more time on the collapse model after today. So I mentioned that there are two ontologies for the local variables. So John Bell said that the collapse centers, those are the flashes, those should be the ontology. So the tables and chairs are made out of these local flashes, and the flashes actually happen in three space. So they are a natural candidate for that. Gerardi had an alternative approach where he calculated a mass density using the wave function and got an ontology from that mass density. I won't write down how he does that. On account of time. So let me just mention a few more things. So there's two kinds of empirical predictions you can get from these models. The first is you would see a loss of interference at large objects. Okay. And Penrose has an explicit experiment where that happens. What it does is he gets a small mirror into a superposition of being in two places at once inside an interferometer, and he's able to show that that if you have a collapse, you'll see one effect, and if you don't, you'll have another effect. And then the other type of effect is that you get energy production. So this model doesn't conserve energy. And let me show you some space on this board. If you have, for example, a system, it could be a system in a ground state, say an atom in a ground state. So you have some sort of wave function like this. It could be an atom in the ground state or whatever. Now you hit it with a jump. Well, the Gaussian is much bigger than the original wave function, but afterwards, after this jump, the new state of the atom will be slightly different than it was before. It might be slightly asymmetric. It'll have a different shape. Okay, and that means it's no longer in the ground state. It now has a small probability of being in an excited state. If you do a Fourier series, or if you do an analysis in terms of the complete set of orthogonal functions. So then you have a small probability that the atom has been excited, And if it's been excited, then it will decay. Yeah. It will emit a photon. So if you have a lot of atoms, you have a big vat of atoms all in the ground state, then they will emit photons. And this is not explained by any, would not be explained by any other process. Now the problem is it's very difficult to isolate systems sufficiently well that you can be sure that this isn't because of some, you know, some thermal noise or some other process. So you'd have to do a very careful experiment to actually measure that, especially if you choose tau and A to be appropriate. Okay. And then finally, squeeze this out. So the criticisms. One is the one we discussed. It's hard to make it relativistic in two senses. It's hard to make it consistent with quantum field theory. It's also the ontology is fundamentally seems to fundamentally have a preferred frame of reference. Okay. Another criticism, which I've mentioned already, is that it's an effective, it's very much an ad hoc approach. Really, to make this sensible, you'd have to find some fundamental way of deriving it. And then finally, and I think I mentioned this when we were talking about many worlds, or maybe about the de Broglie-Bohm model. In this model here, when you hit with a Gaussian, you have this Gaussian here has a long tail, so it doesn't completely kill this other function. And so you still have stuff going on over here, and that's true also if you have many particles. And so this story I told you, this argument from functionalism, that if you have something really going on, then isn't that a true story? It kind of applies in the collapse models as well. The amplitudes are now very small, but they're still there. And so you have an attack, a kind of many worlds in denial attack also on these class models. So that's it. Okay. Any questions? Just out of curiosity, do people have a favorite of the three? I mean, you may just not like any of them. I presented three interpretations in detail.
I think de Broglie-Bohm model was the most sophisticated.
De Broglie-Bohm. I mean, I did cheat and spend two lectures on that. It's my. I think maybe even a bit more than two. Any other favorites? De Broglie-Bohm. Yeah. Sorry.
De Broglie-Bohm.
De Broglie-Bohm. Yeah. Oh dear. Okay.
I found when you presented on many worlds, like I was expecting heavier criticism. So I was like, that's not so bad. Like,
oh, right. Okay. Okay. Really? Okay. So for you, many worlds isn't so.
Yeah, isn't so implausible.
It's so implausible. Yeah.
The most exciting one. Like, it has more plates to work.
Yeah. You can actually do experiments. Yeah. Yeah. My own personal feeling is, my opinion is that, we're not really. None of those interpretations will be right, but I think the collapse might be the rightest of them because it might be the limit of some deeper theory. Yeah. But it's also really messy. The way I presented it is kind of ugly, and there isn't a beautiful version of it. As far as I'm aware, they're all ad hoc.
This one is the one that has the biggest problem with covariance, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I have to admit, I'm not completely up to date with the most modern state of affairs. There are people in Trieste who work on collapse models. So Garadi, he's no longer alive, but Garadi, we had a group in Trieste, and there's people still there who are working on this. And there's other people trying to do experiments of macroscopic superpositions. So that could yield some experimental insight.
That was one of the questions I wanted to ask. Like, even
this paradox that Perlos talks about. Like, when you believe in the microscopic superposition, then it means that you actually don't believe in collapse, at least in some sense, because otherwise you cannot, like, retrieve covariance by having gravitational objects in microscopic.
Yeah. So we can talk a bit more about that. I think there's a, yeah, there's a paper by Bruckner and Giacomini, so Minier and stuff, relating their work to these Penrose ideas. All right.